Hey, when I was asked to give this talk, it wasn't quite clear to me what the organizer wanted me to talk about, but what I decided to do was to review some of the evidence of connections between AGNs and starburst galaxies. And basically, I'm going to be really restrictive towards the very highest luminosity, both AGNs and starbursts. And then discuss a little bit what I consider sort of plausible scenarios as to how these two phenomena might be connected. So the various observational connections include similar luminosities at the high luminosity end for the starbursts and AGNs. And that is, some of the starburst galaxies seem to get up well up into the quasar-type luminosity, that is 10 to the 12th solar luminosities, the so-called U-lurgs. But more importantly, the luminosity functions actually have sort of similar shapes and absolute values in the local universe at redshift less than 0.1. Then there's also, I'm not going to show any evidence for it, but there's some evidence of continuity of this overall spectral energy distributions as you go from U-lurgs to quasars. That is, you can find a continuous sequence of SEDs crossing the two types. Optical spectral similarities. Many of the U-lurgs show evidence of both starburst type emission lines in the optical and also AGN emission lines in the nucleus. There's strong evidence that the U-lurgs are involved with merging and interaction of galaxies. And there's some evidence, of course, that AGNs also are connected with interaction. If both the species are, in fact, connected with interaction and merging, of course, they should become much more frequent in the early universe, where the space density of galaxies is much higher. And the quasar number density is known to increase, of course, at higher redshift. And we can await results for assertive, which presumably will also show that the Euler distribution increases remarkably at higher redshift. That is, probing rest frame 40, 50 micron emission. Now, the other thing which hasn't been emphasized too much, of course, there is a sort of empirical correlation between the masses of central black holes and the sizes of bulges in galaxies. It also turns out that a significant percentage of the U-lurgs show light distributions in the near infrared, which look like essentially violently relaxed elliptical, like the one-quarter wall distributions. So the various plausible scenarios include, during merging, ISM becomes dumped or concentrated in the center of the galaxy through dissipation, where it can feed a nuclear starburst. And, of course, if there's a pre-existing AGN, some of that matter may actually reach the AGN and feed the accretion disk. Another possibility, which has been emphasized by Colin Norman and myself about 10 years ago, which I'll describe, is it may well be a natural outcome of a concentrated starburst in a galactic nucleus, is in fact that the stellar mass loss from those stars accumulates in the center of a nuclear star cluster and hence can almost do nothing else other than build up a central black hole. Okay, so luminosity functions, they're basically really very similar, and I think we've already seen this plot of the luminosity functions at redshift less than 0.1. for both infrared galaxies, which have keys I've noted with red, that is essentially starburst-type galaxies, and AGN galaxies, you can see that there's a close match in this power law at the high redshift. And this is a plot produced by Sanders and Sofer, which I think most of you have seen. One thing to emphasize, though, is that those U-lurgs are actually not a large fraction of the total luminosity of galaxies, either infrared galaxies or even optical galaxies. They're like 10 to the minus 2 and 10 to the minus 5th of the total luminosity density. But, of course, it's the most interesting element of the component in that galaxy distribution, which can be observed at high redshift. So there's also strong evidence, which I think most people here are quite familiar with, that the U-lurgs are associated with interactions. Here is a table from a review article by Sanders and Mirabel, which, if you concentrate on these three rows here, classifies the galaxies in different luminosity bins, increasing to 10 to the 12th solar luminosities here. in terms of whether there would be classified as a merger, a close pair, or a single galaxy. At the low luminosity bin, two-thirds of the galaxies, in fact, appear to be single. In the high luminosity bin, 95% show evidence of undergoing a merger. Now, this table also nicely summarizes the optical emission line spectra. In the low luminosity bin, the majority, two-thirds, show H2 region-like emission line ratios. In the high luminosity bin, approximately one-third show evidence of AGN hard type emission line ratios. And of course, there's a raging controversy about whether a larger fraction of the actual luminosity is AGN powered or not, the high luminosity bin, which is, but basically the issue is that there's a lot of obscuration in the nuclei of these galaxies, so you may actually not be able to see central AGN. But in any case, the percentage of AGN in these galaxies and the percentage of mergers increases with increasing luminosity. Now, if you want to quantify the starburst, you can, for a standard stellar population, the implied star formation rate is approximately 10 to the minus 10th of the solar of the infrared luminosity or luminosity of that stellar population. So for 10 to the 12 solar luminosities, that implies star formation rates of about 100 solar masses per year in steady state. And the overall estimate of the age of this population is probably 10 to the 8th years based upon dynamical arguments. Now, Tim Heckman has actually derived a relation which indicates that the maximum star formation rate in a system which is dynamically triggered would be just converting the overall gas mass to stars on a crossing time, dynamical crossing time. And you end up with a rate which is given by this formula of about 100 solar masses per year normalized for sort of standard parameters. So maximum rates are approximately what are actually seem to be implied by the observations. Now, the issue of AGN versus starburst has been recently studied with ISO by Tran et al. This is a preprint. And their conclusion, based upon classifying objects as starburst, based upon seeing this PAH feature at 7 microns versus continuum, which is classified as a AGN-type component, is that the dividing line between when you go 50 starburst and 50% AGN is about log L equals 12.3. which is a little higher than what was originally mentioned by Sanders et al. Now, what I want to do is describe some near-infrared imaging obtained with NICMOS camera on HST as part of the GTO team led by Roger Thompson. For that project, we actually imaged 24 LIGs and ULIGs. And the sample of objects is shown here. It contains representative H2 region-like optical spectra, QSOs, liners, and Seyfert spectra. Now, one thing, summarizing the near-infrared morphology, you can see over here is a large fraction of these objects do, in fact, have double nuclei separated by a few arc seconds, although not universally. These are arranged actually in order of increasing luminosity, and there's not a one-to-one correlation between the separation of the nuclei and the luminosity, something that was well known from before. This is California. You have to listen for earthquakes. Okay, so this is a fairly useful diagram, I think, because it sort of quantifies the level of activity in these objects. Plotted vertically is the far infrared luminosity, horizontally, essentially the CO luminosity, or converted with standard Milky Way conversion factors into an H2 mass. Normal galaxies lie along a line here with L over M equals 4 in solar units for the Milky Way. These ULIGs actually have elevated L over M by roughly a factor of 10 to 20 compared to normal galaxies like the Milky Way and M51. So looking at this figure, these objects, if they have any relation to normal galaxies, the enhancement has probably been to increase the infrared luminosity rather than to somehow make more molecular gas to order factors of 2 or so. So basically, the evolution of these objects is up into this area, and the enhancement in the rate of star formation compared to a normal galaxy based upon the L over M increase, is roughly a factor of 10 to 20 compared to normal galaxies. So it's important to recognize, and I think most of you probably do, that these enhanced rates of star formation, even though they only occur for a short fraction of the time, the duty cycle is relatively small, a few percent, they actually, since the rate is elevated by a factor of 10 or 20, it turns out that 25, 30, 50% of the overall star formation may actually be induced by dynamical triggering rather than the sort of quiescent percolated star formation. Here are some of these NICMOS images for six of the ultraluminous galaxies, including our favorite object down here on the bottom, ARP-220, radio, strong radio source, Parkes 1345. And what I now want to show you is the evidence that a lot of these infrared bright galaxies actually have R to the 1/4 laws, and a significant fraction also show a nuclear point source-like component. The R to the 1/4 law making them a little bit similar to the bulge population, which is correlated with AGNs. So here is a summary of what we obtained from radial fits to the light at essentially at two microns with NICMOS. We actually fit both R to the 1/4 and exponential laws, and the ones which are noted in blue here are the galaxies where the R to the 1/4 had a good chi-square and where it was strongly favored over the exponential disk. So roughly 9 out of 24 fall in that category. Fewer of them seem to be well fit by an exponential disk. So here's what the plotted as function of R to the 1/4, what the light profiles look like. So the ones with the blue dots are the ones where we would say they fit reasonably well by R to the 1/4 law in terms of the chi-square. So that's a complete sample of all 24 galaxies on these two pages. Okay, and then a few of them show a point source component, but not very many show the point source dominating. Here is an example of a point-like component in the nucleus. The vertical bar in each of these figures indicates the diffraction resolution of the imaging. So a slightly smaller percentage than have R to the 1/4 laws show these nuclear point source components. Some more. But it's important to keep track of what your spatial resolution, of course, is on the galaxy in doing these fits. In terms of colors of the nuclei in these galaxies, here are the near-infrared 1.6 to 2.2 micron color and 1.1 to 1.6 micron color. And then the points are the solid triangles. A starburst population evolves like this and reaches a sort of steady state color of about 300 million years here. Adding extinction shifts the points up further. And you can see that obviously a significant fraction of the objects could be satisfied by a starburst population of age 100 million years and probably 10, 15 magnitudes of visual extinction. On the other hand, some of the more luminous objects, which are over here, actually show colors indicative of a hot dust component in the nucleus and colors which are more similar to that of a PGQSO, this X here, with hot dust added in. So the colors seem to indicate basically a mix of populations. And what I want to do now is to discuss one object in particular, ARP-220, which I think should give you a physical intuition for the processes occurring in these galaxies. ARP-220 is the object we can study best, but it's been imaged at millimeter wavelengths in CO and submillimeter dust continuum, and with NICMOS, as I've just shown. It's at 70 megaparsecs, so 1 arc second corresponds to about 300 parsecs. So here is the NICMOS image showing the two nuclei embedded in heavy obscuration there. And there is CO imaging, which indicates a total mass of a few times 10 to the ninth solar masses concentrated in this central region of the galaxy, only 500 parsecs across. So, I mean, just think about it. It's a spectacular environment for both star formation and feeding any pre-existing black hole. And here's a whole galactic mass of interstellar gas concentrated in a few hundred parsecs. Here's the evidence for that. If you look at the high-resolution CO imaging shown here, CO2 to 1 at half arc-second resolution shows two peaks here, also in the 1 millimeter dust continuum measured interferometrically. And then down here is the velocity contours as you cross those two nuclei. And the point that you should obtain out of this is that the velocities actually run in opposite directions as you cross the two nuclei. So the picture we would like to present here is that within each nucleus there's a disk of gas which is rotating in the opposite sense for the two nuclei as counter-rotating disk. And here are just velocity cuts across each nucleus. So one nucleus has this velocity gradient. The other nucleus has this velocity gradient. This feature is just a repetition of that. Now, if you look in more detail at the NICMOS data, it also shows evidence of a disk in the center of the galaxy, as indicated by the fact that the 2-micron light is very sharply cut off on the bottom, and it's possible that one model for this is that there's essentially an opaque dust disk which is obscuring the bottom part of the central star cluster. Thor is not happy. Okay, so to get a little bit quantitative, the parameters which we derive from the CO data are quite interesting. One is that the dynamical mass turns out to be about 2 times 10 to the 9 for each of these two nuclei, as determined from the kinematics and the size of the region. The gas mass using CO to H2 conversion factor, half of what it would be in the Milky Way, is about 10 to the 9th solar masses. One thing which is really interesting is, and quite different from nearby galactic nuclei, is that it looks like this gas is actually filling the space of the disk, not like in our galactic center where you have a few isolated GMCs. And the evidence for that is if you actually look at the brightness temperature is about 40 degrees in the CO line, which, remember, the beam is about 200 parsecs. In order to obtain a brightness temperature of 40 degrees implies that the gas has to significantly fill the area of the beam. And so basically the picture we'd like to paint is that there's essentially a sort of filled gas disk, not a bunch of isolated molecular clouds. Now, in that disk, the density is extremely high. The evidence for it actually being a disk as opposed to a spherical distribution is that the velocity dispersion is actually small compared to the rotation velocity. Velocity dispersion is like 1/5 of the overall rotation velocity gradient. So, and also, of course, a disk is entirely natural that vertical motions in the gas at this level of concentration will be rapidly damped out. So one possibility is that that disk actually becomes self-regulating through its star formation. Higher rates of star formation puff up the disk and reduce the rate of star formation. And Colin Norman and Tim Heckman and myself at one point sort of worked out what that sort of self-regulation would produce in terms of the star formation rate. And it turns out that you can get about 100, maybe 200 solar masses per mass of gas and per dynamical solar mass that's sort of the maximum self-regulating rate as a result of balancing radiation pressure from the young population against gravity in the disk. Okay, some more evidence that you can have gas in nuclei of these Eulergs, and in particular in some which actually have AGNs. Here are double nuclei Eulergs. These are warm far infrared spectra, cold far infrared spectra. In the warm ones, Evans et al. Actually find that the CO is concentrated on the nucleus, which would be classified as an AGN, rather than on the starburst type nucleus. That's the only point I want to make there. That is, the gas is not just associated with starbursting activity. Here is, of course, the radio galaxy 3C293, which also shows a dense gas disk in its center. sorry, I'm going a little fast, shown CO in blue here, and 5 gigahertz radio continuum, essentially orthogonal to the disk in the nucleus. Okay, so let me quickly go through what I think is happening in these galaxies. And some of this is not a large leap of faith based upon the data I presented. One is that galaxy-galaxy interactions, or conceivably bars in some case, lead to significant dissipation of both angular momentum, the transfer of angular momentum, dissipation of rotational energy, and accretion of the gas to the nucleus, where the vertical motion of that gas will be rapidly damped out, leaving a thin disk within the nucleus in which star formation will occur very rapidly as a result of the very high density of gas, high concentration. So you could end up with a regulated starburst in that disk. And then there are two possibilities. That disk may feed a pre-existing central black hole, or it may be, as I'll describe in a second, it may be that mass loss from the young star population could also build up and feed a black hole. So the basic model, which Colin and I worked on about 10 years ago, was that the young stellar population has a high rate of evolution. The massive stars evolve rapidly off the main sequence, become red giants. The red giants lose material, shed it into the interstellar medium. That mass loss can do two things. One, it can be photoionized if there's a strong UV field. These mass loss envelopes have high density, and that photoionized gas actually shows many of the characteristics of the so-called broad emission lines seen in quasars. It turns out, then if you follow what happens to that gas, what happens in our modeling is that if the gas or the star is close enough to the central luminosity source, or AGN, the dust which comes out in the mass loss envelope will actually be sublimated or evaporated, melted, if the equilibrium temperature is greater than about 1500 degrees. So stars inside of some radius, the dust will be destroyed. The dust provides a significant source of opacity for the gas, and so radiation pressure acting on this mass loss material becomes much less. And in a nutshell, the mass loss material which is lost within that sublimation radius will necessarily fall into the center of the cluster and could feed and build up a central black hole. Alternatively, if the star is outside of that sublimation radius, the mass loss material will feel strong radiation pressure from some central AGN and could be blown out by radiation pressure. Now, where is that sublimation radius? Well, for 10 to the 12 solar luminosities, the equilibrium temperature is about 1,500 degrees at a distance of 1 parsec. So this is sort of AGN-type luminosity. At 1 parsec, the dust will be destroyed. Material inside of that radius might fall in. Material outside would be accelerated outwards by radiation pressure. Turns out that for this luminosity, this distance, initial distance away from that luminosity source, the terminal velocity by radiation pressure acting on this material will be a tenth the speed of light. So the terminal velocity ends up being comparable with the maximum velocities observed in broad absorption line features in quasars. So these are features which are described in these papers by Scoville and Norman, Norman and Scoville. And quantitatively, they seem to work out. I'm not saying it's the only possibility, but simply it's a plausible connection which may link the starburst phenomena with AGNs. Okay, so I think what I want to do at this point is, very conveniently, time is up. Thank you very much.
So comments or questions?
Rosie.
Yeah.
You were focusing on the nuclear starburst in your talk, but I'm just curious, what is the evidence for the spatial distribution of the starburst in these systems? Is it completely in the center, or is there a significant fraction further out?
My opinion is that in the ULURGs, the starburst tends to be very nuclear concentrated. If you go to lower luminosity, then the starburst can be in much larger areas of the galactic disk. An example of that type of situation would be the antennae, where a major part of the starburst is actually in the so-called overlap region, where the two galaxies are overlapping. And I think if you listen to, or if you, Chris Mihels has made this point on the basis of dynamical simulations, that during the first pass, you may have a starburst fairly far out in the galaxy at low intensity, with the material not sinking directly to the center as a result of the heating by the galactic bulge. But then on later passes, as the galaxies actually merge, then that material collisionally dissipates into the center, and you end up with the Ullert phase.
Okay. Just add to that, on the observational side, if you look, say, take long slit spectra of some of these objects, you do see K plus A postburst spectra across the whole face of these. So, but of course, with even integrated rate that's small compared to what you're seeing in the dust obscured regions, so I think it would be consistent with the picture, but not necessarily requiring a picture that you build a bulge outside of this nuclear concentration,
right.
Part and parcel of the process.
Yeah, the other side of the coin is, in this connection with the AGNs, is there are some AGNs which show this A-type stellar spectra in a disk around them,
yeah.
Such as 3C48.
Nick, in this model that you have star formation in a disk, and then within a parsec or so, the dust is evaporated.
Yes.
Isn't there still a problem with angular momentum? I mean,
yeah,
to get the gas into the center, you have to.
Yeah, no, that's an intrinsic problem of all, you know, AGN accretion, getting from a few parsecs down into, you know, Schwarzschild radius type distance. That's not a problem I'm going to deal with.
Okay.
I mean, there are a lot smarter people in this room who can worry about that. The advantage of the star formation, the starburst model, linking that with the AGNs, which I forgot to mention, is that intuitively it seemed to Colin and myself that, you know, once an AGN turns on, it will probably destroy interstellar clouds in its immediate environment and push them outwards. And so it's a little hard to imagine how interstellar clouds can get accreted onto an AGN which is already active. And the advantage of the starburst model is that the young stars which are evolving provide a significant reservoir of fresh material to feed the AGN, which basically, well, at least while the material's in the star, it doesn't get disrupted by the AGN. Sorry, Kerry.
The picture is very plausible. I was led to think of what the post-starburst galaxies would look like. And obviously you'd have a nuclear disk of stars, and those are sometimes observed. But then the numbers didn't seem to work out.
Yeah, that's true.
Because if you say 10 or 20% of the integrated star formation in the galaxy, in the average galaxy, averaging over galaxies, occurs in this form, then 10 to 20% of the old stars, if it was a normal mass function, 10 to 20% of the light would come from the inner few parsecs. And I don't think that that's empirically true.
Yeah.
So the integrated amount of light from starbursts, if it's really due to star formation and it's really a normal mass function, would lead 10 to 20% of the light later on coming from this.
Yeah.
And I don't think that that's right, but the greater experts are around.
No, I think that's a good point. The initial point I thought you were going to make also is where are the evolved versions of the Ullert.
Right, that's what I'm saying.
But that is in terms of, you know, strong A-type. You know, there should be a lot of galaxies with strong A-type stellar spectra, you know, which are still bright. But you're also making the strong point that there should be, you know, there should be the strong nuclear concentration of the light.
Right. You're saying there's a strong A-type spectra
in
the A-type light here.
Right.
Well, let's wait until the 10th.
Yeah, right.
And we should see in the nearby galaxy a lot of light coming out, unless it's biased.
I mean, I think a typical bulge to disk ratio might be, what, a third or 25% or so. But that, I know, but only a small fraction is in the nuclear bulge. So, no, it's a good point. Nobody's made that point.
Everything, the integrated light.
Yeah, no.
The integrated far infrared is a significant fraction of the total bulge.
Yeah, but actually, Rosie's made a good point, because when I extrapolate to indicate a total starburst-induced luminosity. You don't just take the U-lurge, you have to go down in luminosity, and most of that luminosity is actually contributed by 10 to the 11, you know, a few L-star type infrared galaxies. And those may be much more extended than the picture I painted here. So, I mean, both of you have a good point, I think.
Yeah, I wanted to ask why stellar red giant mass loss material should have a privileged role over material that is left over by star formation.
Well, my presumption has been that once you turn on a very powerful AGN, at least the interior disk of sort of tenuous starburst type gas at density 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 will be disrupted within, you know, 10 parsecs or maybe 20 parsecs. So basically, this is just a, I mean, if you have a starburst, necessarily there will be stars which evolve in the course of time. In a few times in the 8 years, approximately 25% of the material is put back in the interstellar space. But that's not to say, obviously, if some remnant star formation material was left over in that region, that would also obviously capably feed an AGN. Sometimes you don't wake up quite right and the words don't quite come.
I can interpret in what you say that the merger events that are often correlated with these starbursts are not themselves supplying fresh interstellar medium to the nuclear starburst region.
They are in the sense that the interstellar medium has been redistributed in the galaxies, but it's not intergalactic medium.
No, I mean,
approximately
is it
probably a third of the interstellar medium is dispersed in the tidal tails, which are predominantly atomic, and then the stuff which is concentrated in the central disk is molecular, but it derives from probably the region out to 8, 10 kiloparsecs originally.
But is that not competitive with the rate of producing mass loss from the red giants as a supply of material to feed?
Yeah, no, I'm presuming these are occurring at different temporal times. That is, the initial accretion of material into the nucleus feeds a starburst, and then it may be that a lot of that material gets dispersed. Maybe it sits there. But then, anyway, that starburst will have mass loss, which then subsequently feeds the AGN. I'm not sure whether I really answered your question.
I was just trying to determine whether there were two sources of mass which are sufficient to feed the central object.
Yes.
And which also are temporary.
Yes.
One of which comes from the post stellar evolution to the red giant stage that you talked about, and the other, which is the redistribution of interstellar gas from the merger.
Yeah. The redistribution of stellar gas, if that feeds the AGN, that occurs early on. The starburst mass loss, that occurs over a long period of time of the order of 500 million years, so it's not short-lived. I mean, I didn't get to. Well, obviously, that material which has been processed would have higher metal abundances, and there's some evidence in, you know, the line emission that the abundances are enhanced, particularly in the broad absorption lines. But, you know, there are other explanations. So.
Do you have a sense of what accounts for the very large range in infrared luminosities of galaxies? Is it entirely the star formation rate, or is it the dust content varying from galaxy to galaxy as well?
I think it's the star formation rate.
Almost
which
entirely.
May have, it obviously varies based on the encounter geometry, but then the initial galaxies may have more or less interstellar medium. I think the dust is almost always adequate to degrade the starburst luminosity into the far infrared, because it doesn't require much optical and UV opacity to absorb all the radiation, as long as the covering factor is large.
Crystal Martin?
If the stars that you form in these starbursts extend down to like 0.1 solar masses or something, then you would continue to get some mass loss in the central region. I mean, for billions of years, it's the planetary nebula formed in things from the lower mass stars. So it seems like you could continue to feed the central disk. And can you say anything like from the duty cycle of the AGN in these objects?
Well, I don't know what the current thinking is on the duty cycle of AGNs, but I mean, it used to be that it was a few percent of the time an AGN would be active. But I don't know what the current thinking is. What? Even less, I think. But what? Less than, apparently. What, 10 to the minus 4? That's 10 to the minus 3. Then. Well, but, I mean, the mass loss, if the material to feed the AGN is coming from this evolved stellar population, that mass loss rate continuously drops as a function of time. And so you may get to a point at which the mass loss is sufficiently low that there's not a critical mass accumulating within the accretion disk and the material just gets blown out. But
one can estimate the amount of gas that's collected in the
So the material is getting presumably blown out. Is that right?
That's one of the motivations for the ascent action on the accretion disk, that we increase the variable.
It's interesting that.
On that point as well, I think it's much more plausible that you use that gas for low-level accretion later on than actually having a short phase as an optical bright QSO. So that might be a completely different thing than what we normally think an AGN is. So that material will be there and will probably be accreted, but with low efficiency. And I think it's not very plausible that this short AGN phase of 10 to 7 years actually occurs from that material. That might just be some of the gas that during that starburst is driven to the center and doesn't feel the force of the stars, and then you see the AGN maybe if the dust is blown out and see it for a short time in the end, and then the AGN stops the starburst in a sense.
Yeah, I had a little bit of trouble understanding.